we turn to some very scary reminders of the Stalin period in the Soviet Union, where people were forcibly resettled in the 1950s and 60s. Among those resettled, the Tatars, Muslims in Crimea, moved east under wretched, sometimes fatal conditions, who slowly returned to Crimea, which is now in Ukraine and at the center of the current Ukraine crisis, even though the Tatars have lived there peacefully for decades. Joining us now once again is Natalia Antalava, reporting for PRI's The World from Crimea. Natalia, welcome.
Thank you very much. Hello.
Natalia, are Tatar homes being marked in neighborhoods as they were decades ago during the Stalinist resettlement period, based on your reporting?
Well, we have heard reports for a while of this marking on the doors of Crimean Tatars here, who are in a very vulnerable position at the moment. And yesterday, I did see the evidence of these markings. I went to a mixed Russian-Crimean Tatar neighborhood in the city of Bakhchisarai, and the street that, you know, I personally saw, it was a very small street with about 12 houses, five of which belong to Tatars, and all five of them had crosses scratched into the front gates of their homes. The people that I spoke to, the Tatar families I spoke to, said that, you know, they saw over the weekend men whom they described as skinheads, shaved men with tattoos and earrings going around the neighborhood armed with batons, and the women I talked to said they had lists, and that's how they marked their homes, according to the list they were holding. This is obviously a completely chilling experience for anyone who has gone through the Stalin deportation in 1944. I was talking yesterday to an elderly woman who, when she was 8 in 1944, her home was marked in exactly the same fashion, and literally a couple of days later, the soldiers came to their house and threw the entire family on trains and deported them into exile in Central Asia, where she spent decades, and where thousands and thousands of the Crimean Tatars died. So, and the community leaders here are saying that this is just a sign of the pressure that they are under, because the community is very much very supportive of the government in Kiev. It's a very pro-Ukrainian community, and they very much oppose the Moscow intervention in Crimea, but they also fear that they will be the ones who will pay the price for this opposition.
Well, the political conundrum there for the Crimean Tatars, who and it sounds as though this marking of homes is not being officially sanctioned, but it is an opportunity for some ideological groups. Before we go, is that true?
Well, as you know, President Vladimir Putin of Russia says that there are no troops present in Crimea at the moment, which is the most puzzling announcement, really. It has been for, you know, it's been a bit of a joke for all the journalists who are here, because we see these Russian troops every day. But people who, you know, the locals here say that the danger comes not so much from the disciplined Russian troops who just stand there, but from the tensions that the presence of these troops has unleashed. In the last few days, we have seen, you know, I have personally been pushed around and, you know, called names by, you know, several Cossacks and supporters of Putin, this volunteer brigade that we see everywhere. The Crimean Tatars are very wary of the pro-Moscow government that came to power here, because they say that a lot of extremist nationalists groups are behind and have always been supportive of these people who are now in power.
Very, very worrying situation there in Crimea. Natalia Antaleva reporting for PRI's The World from Crimea. Meanwhile, the West grapples with what to do about this crisis in Europe.
Crimea is part of Ukraine. Crimea is Ukraine.
Secretary of State John Kerry is correct if he's looking at a contemporary map of the region, but the people of Crimea want to vote to end and decide whether to change that map and become part of Russia. President Obama doesn't like this at all.
The proposed referendum on the future of Crimea would violate the Ukrainian constitution and violate international law. Any discussion about the future of Ukraine must include the legitimate government of Ukraine.
The Ukraine crisis has stirred up Europe and the West, but we're going to look east now, far east, because possibly the most important implications for this crisis in the coming years will be how it plays out in a similar way among aspiring nationalist movements in Asia and redefines the relationship between China, Russia, India, and Japan. Roger Baker is the vice president of the Asia-Pacific Analysis Group, Stratfor, a global intelligence research firm. This crisis gives Russia a lot of options in Asia, he says, of all places, however it all turns out in Europe.
What the Russians are likely to do is really try to accelerate their relationship with Japan at this time. That's a key U.S. ally. The Japanese have a very strong interest in securing their relationship with Russia for easy access for natural gas, to resolve some of the island disputes that they have, to secure their northern flank.
And also to have just someone in their corner to face China.
Certainly. And so Russia is likely to be more willing to make a deal on the northern territories, on the Kuril Islands, maybe strike something that the Japanese are going to be willing to accept, so the Japanese start putting money into eastern Russia. At the same time, though, Russia won't side only with Japan. They're going to make sure that they strike a similar gas deals with the Chinese so that Russia remains the arbiter in the area and not dependent upon one of these consumers.
Is the dynamic going forward in Asia that Russia stays secure and together and that China simply goes stronger? Or are we going to see more evolution of the map of Asia in the early part of this century?
The place where Russia and China are really going to have some competition is over Central Asia. The Chinese have expanded substantially into Central Asia for energy resources, for transportation routes. And if Russia is reasserting its national self-interest in its near abroad, in its periphery, at some point this is going to run up against the Chinese. And we're looking now at several of the leaders in Central Asia who have been there forever, who are very old, who don't have a good succession plan, and are already having some crises within their own political organizations.
So as Russia attempts to expand in Europe, we may see a rollback of the traditional Russian, territorial conquest of Siberia and Central Asia in this century?
Or the Russians decide that they really need to push that as well, and it puts the Russians into a more confrontational attitude with the Chinese than we've seen in a long time.
Do you believe that the Russians can win a battle with the Chinese over Central Asia, or will it fall apart?
I think that Russia has more levers in Central Asia still than the Chinese do. The Chinese have been throwing money in, but the Russians have very long-standing relationships. The Russians have a standing military presence. But the risk in Central Asia is that as we start to see these leaders die, that there is no way for the countries to hold together. And if you go back to the way in which the Soviets designed the shape of the region, they intentionally cut and split and altered all the different ethnic groups so that they overlap and so that none of the five stands can ever really be truly dominant in the region. And that competition within the stands rises up. The Russians and the Chinese take sides, and you can have some particularly interesting crises happening in that area.
And it's also the case that the long history of Russia in Central Asia and Siberia has produced grievances. I mean, there are angsts and grievances against the Russians that if the power shifts, will rise up and, push people into the Chinese sort of zone of influence, I would suspect.
There certainly are, but the Chinese in some ways are playing with fire as well, because a lot of these groups in Central Asia that are opposed to Russia are the same groups that could be linked into, say, the ethnic Turkestani and the Uyghurs in China's far west. And these are the ethnic groups that the Chinese are worried about, the ones who may have been responsible, for example, for the attack in Kunming this week.
Will we see an Asia that looks more like the Balkans, only 1,000 times the size of the territories, sometime this century?
Central Asia, I think that's a possibility.
And that would be hugely destabilizing for the world. I mean, that's a kind of Sarajevo.
It is, but in some sense, it's very isolated in its location.
So was Sarajevo in 1914.
Yeah, but a little bit closer to the rest of Europe. If Central Asia starts to unravel, the Chinese really can't focus on their maritime frontier, for example. That gives the Japanese the opportunity to expand their involvement and their action in maritime East Asia. So the Chinese are looking at trying to figure out the way to balance their western frontier and their eastern frontier, which they feel they're being sort of pressed in upon by the United States, by the Japanese, and by their allies.
Does that unraveling favor the United States or produce a kind of Guns of August mentality in the 21st century that could just produce all kinds of unexpected surprises?
Certainly unexpected surprises, but we see the United States shifting from what has been sort of expected from the Cold War period and the early post-Cold War period of a global hegemon or a global policeman role to a United States that's more ready to rely on, say, regional balance of power roles. So that rather than direct intervention, the U.S. only gets involved such that no single power can become dominant. And that means that there's a greater acceptance of regional instability.
So that means, that's conceivably a formula for allowing some of these territories to change hands in the early going and figuring out what the red lines are down the road. Maybe the U.S. only has an interest in allowing Putin to take Crimea. And the question is, will they feel the same about Uzbekistan?
Yeah, and I think the whole concept of red lines is going to go away pretty fast because they seem to be, if you choose not to enforce them, they're fairly useless in the first place. But the U.S. is going to accept more of these types of changes, more local competition, just so long as no single power is able to dominate. So if it means that the Chinese and the Russians are having heavy competition in Central Asia, that in some sense is of benefit to the United States because the countries are focused on that area where they meet and not focused on expanding in other directions.
Roger Baker, Vice President of Asia Pacific Analysis at Stratfor, a global intelligence research firm. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.